Imagine you live under a violently repressive government. One day, a loved one is murdered, or worse, simply disappears. You hear rumors about what happened, but you don't know the truth. For years, you live with uncertainty. Now, imagine your country frees itself from the shackles of repression. Would you still want to know the truth? Would you want to sit in a public hearing and listen to something like this?
Meneer Kalata, work van achteraf.
I hit Mr. Kalata from behind with this heavy iron object, approximately where the head joins the neck. He fell to the ground. I cut the petrol pipe from the Honda to pour over Mr. Guniwi's and Galata's bodies, and I set both these bodies alight.
Eric Taylor, telling the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission how he murdered Fort Kalata. Sitting in the room that day was Kalata's widow, Nomondi.
You know what has hurt me the most is to hear that he was killed, and after that he was killed, his body was burned. You know, that hurts me a lot.
After such testimony, could you forgive? Connection listeners, we're talking about Truth and Reconciliation Commissions this hour. Is the Truth Commission process a real help in rebuilding a nation? Or is it simply a band-aid on a festering machete wound? How high a price should a society pay to hear the truth? Amnesty for murderers? Call 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255, and join the Truth and Reconciliation Commission Connection. You can also join the conversation online at www.theconnection.org. Our guest this hour, Priscilla Hayner, who's the author of Unspeakable Truths, and a recently published book about the work of truth commissions around the world. She's also the program director for the International Center for Transitional Justice, and we'll be joined in a moment from South Africa by Yasmin Suka, who's a commissioner on the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Good morning, Priscilla. Let's begin at the beginning. When did this whole idea of having truth commissions start?
Well, the first better-known commission, which was really attracted attention internationally, was in Argentina in the mid-1980s, immediately after the end of the seven-year military rule there. At that time, these bodies, which were starting to appear in other countries as well, were not first known generically as truth commissions. It was only over time when we realize we're seeing the same kind of inquiry coming up in different countries that they gained this generic Truth Commission title.
But did it come up from a grassroots thing, or was it something the new government decided they needed to have?
At the beginning, it came more out of the political necessity to confront the past, usually on the initiative of a new president. A new democratic government came in, and there was a sense that the past had to be confronted, that there were too many unknowns, too many victims that both had their own truth denied and could not speak publicly about what had happened because of the sense of threat. And in the intent and interest of bringing forward what happened and building new institutions that would not allow such abuses to happen in the future, a new democratic president would create a commission. Over time, it has included more of a public movement in seeking the truth. It went much beyond a political initiative.
But in the case of Argentina, for example, I mean, the junta fell shortly after Argentina's defeat in the Falklands War. Was the national mood there really open to this kind of self-examination? Because my memory is that the war over the Malvinas, as the Argentines would call them, Falklands as the British call them, actually it was a real trauma, national trauma, over and above the abuses committed during the reign of the junta.
That's exactly right. And ironically, for the armed forces in Argentina, it was the loss, the tremendous loss of that in that war that turned the tide on the public's attitude towards the regime, although abuses, fairly widespread and remarkable abuses in retrospect, once the full truth was known, were ongoing for the full 7 years. It was only with this incredible defeat that the full public turned against the armed forces, and there was a sense that they were completely out, and there was suddenly a full public will and interest in knowing exactly what they had been up to for 7 years.
Let me bring Yasmin Suka into the conversation in South Africa. Good day, Yasmin.
Hi, Michael. Hi, Priscilla.
Hello.
Okay. Listen, what was the origin of the Truth and Reconciliation movement in South Africa?
It was also part of a political compromise that was made by the South African government. One must remember at the time when this idea was being mooted, the government, you know, the then liberation forces were trying to negotiate with the other side. And of course, at the last hour, they say on the stroke of midnight, before the interim constitution was going to be agreed upon, the generals, in fact, were holding up the former state to ransom and saying, we're not going to go into this process unless you secure some kind of deal for us. And at that moment, the liberation movement had to say, okay, we'll give you amnesty, but it's not going to be a blanket amnesty. What will happen is when we have this constituent assembly set up, they're going to actually determine what the form of that amnesty is going to be. So you can see it's born out of the need for a political deal so that, in fact, the transition process can move forward. And so when we deal with the Truth Commission, we have to see it against that backdrop of the political compromise.
That wasn't the case in Argentina, though, Priscilla.
It wasn't the case, especially as Yasmin is outlining, the amnesty ingredient, which was included in South Africa, has not been included in the powers of any other Truth Commission to date. On the other hand, there is a mix of both public interest and a demand for truth and the political need to account for the past beyond a compromise, which sometimes feels a bit like a compromise if prosecutions can't be put forward immediately, but also a sense of accounting for the past, naming who was responsible, naming the institutions responsible.
Okay, well, that seems to me that we've got to there are two underlying pillars of this whole movement. Yasmin, what you're saying then is that the South African process was, in a sense, it was almost judicial, that rather than face prosecution, the military wanted to make sure that it basically cut itself a deal. And so the truth in the whole idea of giving testimony, getting amnesty, was a kind of halfway house in the legal process.
Yeah, you could say that, but then you must also remember that what could have happened to the process was that it would only have been a sort of quasi-judicial process dealing with amnesty. But almost one of the sort of pillars that you hang this on is the kind of moral issue which arose out of the ANC itself, which was saying, look, this is not enough just to deal with perpetrators. What we also need to know is, what do we do about our own victims? What do we do in the absence of a judicial process which deals with prosecutions? How do we find out the truth? And in a sense, what they coupled that with was an investigation into gross human rights violations. So then you have a law which actually doesn't just look at the granting of amnesty, but also looks at a truth-telling process where victims themselves can come and tell their stories to the commission and can actually begin to find out through the amnesty process about what's happened to loved ones. And so, in a sense, you have the moral compromise, the moral issue of trying to look after victims, and the political process, which looks at how do we handle these guys who've done these bad things, but whom we know, from a political perspective, we still will need to ensure that they don't actually stage a coup. We still know that we need them in the civil service. We still need them in government. The economy is still in their hands.
So, Yasmin, So basically, you're dealing, in a sense, with realpolitik there. Priscilla?
Realpolitik, yeah.
I mean, what you're describing as being in South Africa is very much true elsewhere. The dynamic of victims coming forward in some countries, as was true in South Africa, in public hearings, in many other countries only behind closed doors, primarily for concerns of security, still the impact of their ability to come forward and speak to an official government-sponsored inquiry and say exactly what happened, and especially after many years of a government explicitly saying to victims, oh, what you're claiming didn't happen, of course your loved ones weren't disappeared, suddenly there's a government which is formally acknowledging what took place, and the power of that can be remarkable.
I think it's incredibly important, because you must remember, up until that time, most white people in our country said that it didn't happen. And in fact, when the victims first began testifying, most white people said, this can't be true, these things couldn't have happened. And then suddenly you have the perpetrators also coming forward, and their stories are even more ghastly. And then the discourse changes to, look, we didn't know that these things were happening. And I think the effect of the commission has been, for once and for all, to put aside the myth that these things didn't happen in the name of apartheid. And that, you know, dealing with the denial, I think is a very important process so that a country can, in fact, move forward.
Connection listeners, excuse me, Yasmin. Connection listeners, we're talking about truth and reconciliation commissions around the world. We're talking about the process by which the truth is revealed to people who didn't know what was going on just down the road in the local detention center. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Numbers to call to join the conversation. You can also contact us online at www.theconnection.org. The interesting thing you were talking about there, Yasmin, is that people didn't believe. And I think that the word truth is a loaded one. You have the collective truth of a nation. You have the individual truth of what people believe. And this process, it's amazing how we find out how abstract a notion it really is, that one person's truth is another person's, I don't believe it.
Yes, yes. And I mean, I think that, you know, part of the battle we have now is actually to go behind that truth and, in fact, say, how do we move that truth to a point where, you know, you begin to acknowledge it and also say, given what's happened, what is my role in reconstruction and development, and how do we rebuild our country in terms of taking the national reconciliation process forward? Because I think from what we've learned, the truth is one part of it, but how you make restitution is actually another. If the circumstances under which victims live don't actually change, if they don't have access to the economy, then one has to say, is the truth enough? And I think that's what we're grappling with in South Africa today.
That's exactly true. In other countries, as you describe, Yasmin, also, there is a sense of, first, acknowledge what took place. Second, reform the institution so this is not going to happen tomorrow again. And third, what can we do for the people that were victimized by state actors or by others in a conflict? How can you reach out and provide reparations to them? Sometimes this is in the form of financial reparations, and there have been incredible examples in Chile and Argentina, and to some extent South Africa. I know you all are still working on strengthening the reparations policy, but there are other kinds of symbolic or moral reparations as well, which can also be very, very important.
We're coming up to the break. When we come back, we'll be talking more about the nature of truth and hearing some personal stories about people who have heard the truth in the Truth and Reconciliation process. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, to make the Truth and Reconciliation connection. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is the Truth and Reconciliation Connection.
A healthy, normal reaction to facing the killer of your beloved husband. I mean, I think that you should want to go and just hit them, hurt them, get revenge. I mean, I don't have that reaction, and I know a lot of women don't. Why don't we want to face that person once and only once, and that's through the sights of an AK-47? which is really kind of healthy in a weird way. I don't know what it is, but it seems more normal than wanting to sit down and face them in this extraordinary Kafkaesque truth commission where we sit and listen and go in the breaks and have cups of tea.
Jan Turner, a journalist covering the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission. She was heard in a film called Long Night's Journey into Day, an extremely good documentary about the whole Truth and Reconciliation Commission process in South Africa. Connection listeners, we're talking about that process in this hour. 800-423-8255, excuse me, 800-423-TALK. To join in the conversation, I'm speaking with Priscilla Hainer, who's the author of Unspeakable Truths, a book about the process. She's also program director for the International Center for Transitional Justice. Priscilla, now there is someone who didn't actually suffer from during apartheid years, but just was so stunned by the testimony she heard in one of the courtrooms. How is it for people, not just in South Africa, but you know, in any of the other processes you've investigated, to actually sit in a room with the murderer, the torturer of their loved one, and listen to this?
Sure. And just to be clear, it doesn't come across in that clip, but Jan Turner herself lost her father in the apartheid years, many years ago when she was a small child. And then later she, as you say, reported on the Truth Commission. So she has both sides, which is extremely interesting and difficult as well for her. It's not easy. I have also been in those Kafkaesque tea rooms between the sessions of a hearing where widows have watched perpetrators describe in great detail exactly how they killed these women's husbands. And it's not easy. I spoke with a group of three women who were together sitting on stage listening to perpetrators describe how their three husbands had been killed together. And they each had different responses. One said, you know, if we know the truth, you know, that's enough. I feel better already. She was completely calm. She clearly felt a sense of healing from the process. Another said, this is not a good process for me. They are not telling me the whole truth. They're lying about some aspects. They're denying that torture took place. For her, she wasn't hearing enough. That it wasn't just knowing the basics. She wanted to know every single detail, which was even more surprising to me. And then the third again had a very different reaction. Also, she was glad to be there, but she didn't think the process was enough for her. It's complicated. The process.
Where was this? Was this in South Africa?
This was in South Africa, in Port Elizabeth.
Okay. Now, in other truth commissions, is amnesty usually a prerequisite to get people to come forward?
It's not. Other truth commissions have not had this power to grant amnesties to perpetrators and therefore have had a struggle to get perpetrators to come forward to tell their story to the commission. And none of these testimonies that do come sometimes from perpetrators usually take place in public, as it did in South Africa. So it's a different dynamic in other countries. However, there still is the process of victims coming forward to a commission, talking to the commission, and leaving, sometimes feeling very upset and thinking about, what was this process for me? Sometimes they actually feel more traumatized for having remembered the event many years later and talking about it in such great detail rather than feeling an immediate sense of healing. It's a very mixed reaction.
Connection listeners, can you put yourself in the shoes of someone hearing this testimony? And can you imagine what that must be like? Do you think that would lead to your own sense of being reconciled to what's happened? 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Nancy is calling from Columbia, South Carolina.
Hi. Good morning. I was in South Africa as part of a commission to give advice to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And I want to make two points. One, in response to what the previous caller just said. In fact, there were groups set up to help people who had just given testimony because they recognized that telling the story was also very traumatic. And those people were then referred to NGOs, that non-governmental organizations that assisted them to deal with the trauma. They also dealt with the trauma for the people who were listening to the stories. The commission members and the intake workers were also given psychiatric help. The point I wanted to make was that not everyone was given amnesty. I'm unfortunately sitting in my car and I don't have the figures. They're sitting at home, but I just happened to be looking at them last week.
Well, we have Yasmin Suka still with us in South Africa. Yasmin, okay. can you clarify and help Nancy with her point here?
You know, there were about 7,100 people who applied for amnesty, and thus far only 1,000 have received amnesty. Most of them have, in fact, been refused because they really border on criminal activity and, in fact, are not people who should, in fact, be granted amnesty. And I agree with Nancy, the component of victim support groups was incredibly important for the victims who went through the amnesty process because, you see, part of the process involved them, in fact, coming face-to-face with a perpetrator. And usually those are killers and loved ones or torturers. And, in fact, there's an incredible scene in one of the commission hearings when one of the victims comes face-to-face with his torturer. And he actually says to him, "What kind of person are you that you could have done this to me?" And he asks him graphically to go down on the floor and use him as a model and show the audience what he actually did. And, you know, in the process, the perpetrator responds and says, "I don't know what I've become. And I've actually looked at counseling to look at the monster that I am." And this encounter between victim and perpetrator, although it's traumatic, it's incredibly important in terms of taking the process forward.
Nancy,
and often, sorry.
Yeah. Let me just ask you. What was you say you advised the transmission?
Yes, I was.
Who were you with? You were with an NGO.
I was with a people-to-people group, and there were mediators, and some people in our group were victim offender mediators, and they were the particular ones that gave advice to the commission and talked about transformative mediation. But to continue with Yasmin's point, the people who did get amnesty were acting under specific orders from their particular political party, not taking revenge. And the final point I wanted to make was that South Africa is an absolutely wonderful country, and the people are so special. And this whole mediation process was part of their culture, and that's part of why this worked. The other part is because they learned from Argentina and Chile to add the amnesty part of it.
Well, Priscilla, I mean, this is a critical point. The nature of the society, even when it's been through, you know, an oppressive regime, has to be open to this kind of process. And there have been plenty of places where Truth and Reconciliation Commissions just haven't worked.
Absolutely. I mean, not only does the society have to be open to the process, but it should be a process which comes from them. It must be something that the society, the government, the people wants.
Well, what was the situation in Chile, for example?
In Chile, similar to Argentina, the commission was created very quickly after the transition. And there was a sense that because in Chile there was an amnesty in place which prevented prosecution of the vast majority of the crimes under Pinochet, that there's a sense that at least we can find the full truth and provide reparation to the victims. And it was the commission was created through presidential decree, and it was quite a powerful commission in the effect that it had in bringing out the full truth. That is similar to other countries as well. And what's interesting as we look both at the past and at the current situation with so many new countries around the world looking at the possibility of creating a commission, each and every one to date has been different, and each in the future, I believe, will be different. There's no sense in trying to import a truth commission model from elsewhere. It must be crafted to the national circumstances.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. John is on the line. John, hello.
Hello. My comment is that we need to focus more on the why the things happen instead of the what. When we hold on to the anger around the what, that's where all the focus is on. It's just, you know, let's get this person in, let's prosecute them, let's punish them. But we don't really explore the why. And people who are victims, they always say, "Well, how could this happen? How could this happen?" And we don't explore that. If we could solve the why.
John, thanks for that. Priscilla.
That's exactly right. You couldn't actually have articulated it better. I'll give you the example of Sierra Leone, which is now in the process of putting together a truth commission. When I went there and there had been a truth commission agreed to in a peace accord, but with very little detail behind as actually what it would look for, it was not clear to me that the Sierra Leoneans wanted a truth commission. By the time I left 2 weeks later, I was fully persuaded that there was a clear desire on the part of the public and on the part of victims. And the way they articulated their desire was, we want to understand where this violence and atrocity came from. Why is it that we're cutting off each other's limbs in the course of the Civil War? Why did it become so atrocious as it has become? And I think, as you say, John, understanding the why behind a period of violence, exactly what caused this to take place, what allowed this to take place, and also what do we need to change so that it doesn't take place again, is probably as important, if not more important, than exact details about what took place.
As a satisfactory answer to why in any specific country ever come up?
Perhaps it's never satisfactory, but it can be extremely useful to look closely, even at the mechanics behind the why. If the judicial system had functioned well in El Salvador or in Argentina or even in South Africa, and it wasn't politicized and it was allowed to do the job that it was set out to do, then the atrocities that took place could not have continued because there would have been a check on that. Even at that simple level, a truth commission isn't a place to sit back and say, these are the things that went wrong and these are the things that must change. And it's a slow and difficult process to change those institutions even after a transition into a more democratic regime. On the cultural or psychological level, it's hard to explain. I mean, people come out of some of these countries and say, if it could happen here, it could happen anywhere. Mm. And there's always the possibility that something can break down in society. Many of these countries, Chile, Yugoslavia, they wouldn't have expected this kind of intercommunal or inter-ethnic or inter-religious conflict that, to the extreme that it has taken place.
Yes.
Yasmin.
Sorry. Yes, I must say that was quite an important issue for us. It was not enough just to look at victims and perpetrators. It was important to look at political institutions, the judiciary, the legal profession, the medical profession, and ordinary people as well. Because the question you always have to ask is, how do we make sure it never ever happens again? And what do we put in place to make sure that that doesn't happen? And so, you know, in our country, we had hearings which reflected on different components of civil society to in fact examine their conduct and say, what could we have done better and where did we fail? And I think for us, that was a very important way of moving forward.
In selecting the commissioners for the South Africa Truth and Reconciliation Commission, what was the process, Yasmin?
Very interesting. You know, of course, that civil society was a very big component of participating before the legislation actually was passed. It actually took 1 year before Parliament passed the legislation because civil society interacted with that. They then asked the President for him not to appoint them completely, but rather to set up a structure where you would have representatives of all the different political parties, as well as civil society, the churches, religious community. They then asked people to send in nominations, and I think they received something like 400. They then whittled that down to about 45.
What was your background, Yasmin?
I was a human rights lawyer.
You're a human rights lawyer, right.
Yes.
Okay.
And, you know, through a public process, interviews took place, and the 42 were interviewed in public. And in the meantime, people could write in about you and your background and say, you know, you did this, we don't like it, etc. Then that committee shortlisted 25. And that list then went to the President. He chose 15 people out of that list and then went outside to bring two more in.
I think the amazing thing to me in listening to that description is if something like that were to happen, a similar process in most countries, it would be so quickly politicized. You have so many opportunities to step up and say, no, I reject this person just on political grounds. Yet somehow in South Africa, that didn't happen, and it didn't become a highly charged political selection process.
No, in fact, you know, one of the requirements was that the individual should not have a highly, you know, well-known political background. They should be people of high moral character. They should have had, you know, very sort of, you know, their sort of practical past should have been working within different things, but it was not required that you be aligned with one or other party. And the interesting thing is that two of the people appointed to the commission, one of them came from the former National Party, the former government, and the other came from a very right-wing White Afrikaans party.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Rita is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Yes, hi.
Good morning.
Good morning. I want to make an important clarification regarding the situation in Argentina. First of all, the commission in Argentina that was published its report Nunca Más, Never Again, in 1984, was not a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It was a commission to investigate the fate of the disappeared. It had nothing to do with reconciliation at any level. In fact, in 1985, there was a trial of the junta leaders that had run the country. Several of the junta leaders were condemned to life imprisonment. And what happened is that the following constitutional governments of President Alfonsín and President Menem passed a series of amnesty laws and presidential pardons, which led to the creation...
Rita, I just want to bring Priscilla Hainer in on this.
I couldn't agree with you more, Rita. In fact, as a generic term, I don't call these bodies Truth and Reconciliation Commissions for exactly that reason, that some of them didn't aim for or were not framed around the notion of reconciliation in the way, for example, the South African Commission was. And in addition, you also make the very important point that the commission in Argentina led directly to the prosecutions which followed, and in many ways was perceived as a commission. It wasn't called a truth commission at the time, but a national commission on the disappeared, and it led explicitly to the successful trial of the generals that you described.
Yes, but let me continue. The amnesty laws were passed by the so-called constitutional governments led to the creation of a truly culture of impunity, to which to this day Argentina is paying a price for it. And in fact, last month, for the first time, a judge in Argentina...
Rita, are you are Argentine?
I am Argentine. I have written a book about the grandmothers of the Plaza de Mayo and the disappeared children of Argentina. And I have written again about the issue of impunity.
Rita, we're coming up to the break. I just want to quickly ask you, I'm sorry to interrupt. How do you feel? Do you feel reconciled to the past of your own country?
Absolutely not. I don't confuse vengeance with justice. And I believe that the future of Argentina will only be straightened out when justice will be done. And luckily, last month, an Argentine judge declared that, in his judgment, the amnesty laws are unconstitutional, and this is opening up the door, finally, to new trials for the perpetrators.
Rita, thank you very much for your call. We're talking about the truth and reconciliation process. Sometimes it's truth and reconciliation after the fact. Thank you to Yasmin Suka in South Africa. Thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. Hi, Michael Goldfarb. This is the Truth and Reconciliation Connection. So before the break, we were talking to Rita, who is from Argentina, and almost two decades after the fall of the junta is still not reconciled to her nation's past. I think that the South Africa experience so far has been positive. But, I mean, surely in many of the countries that you've studied, Priscilla Hainer, more people think like Rita than perhaps like people in South
Absolutely.
Africa.
Absolutely. We should not be too simplistic about the notion of reconciliation. And people that assume or suggest that if one knows the truth, that's enough for reconciliation, that just is not always true. It's a much more personal and long-term and profound process than that.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Mary Lee is calling from Waltham, Massachusetts.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to make a couple of quick comments and then ask a question. One, I think it would be helpful to the listeners to hear both Ms. Nsukka and Ms. Hainer discuss the difference between truth and reconciliation and truth and justice, because the truth commissions are frequently called generically truth commissions, when in fact the ones that look at reconciliation are different in their point from those that look at justice. And then the other comment I wanted to make was that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa has some very stringent conditions for amnesty to be considered and granted, and one is that the crime committed must be a political crime. It has to be political in nature and politically motivated. And the second is that the person seeking amnesty must tell the whole truth about what he or she knows about that crime. And then the third, and perhaps in some instances the most difficult condition, is that the perpetrator must be contrite and must show that he or she is contrite. And I think those distinguish the TRC in South Africa from many other truth commissions around the world. I'd appreciate their comments on that. And my quick question is, can a victim's family ask for a hearing, or could a victim's family ask for a hearing in South Africa, or were the cases brought through the commission itself calling people to give their testimony?
Okay, Mary, before I ask Priscilla to answer your last question, let me just ask you, how would you define the difference between reconciliation and justice?
Well, I think it's very, very clear that the truth and reconciliation point is one that seeks to bring the perpetrators of evil back into some sense of wholeness within their own society. And it does follow on what Ms. Hainer mentioned briefly earlier in the conversation, that the Southern African societies in general seek to bring perpetrators of evil, whatever it might be, whether it's political or even criminal, historically, back into the wholeness of the society. And in fact, see any aberration of justice, an aberration of safety or of decent human behavior as the fault not only of the perpetrator, him or herself, but as a failure of the society to correct its own problems. So I think there is a difference, and I think it does, the reconciliation part fits very, very neatly into the Southern African society's values.
Thanks, Mary Lee.
Sure.
I just wanted to address a couple of your questions, Mary Lee. In fact, your last questions, the victim's family or the victim, him or herself, could not request a hearing per se. It had to be up to the perpetrator to apply for amnesty, and only at that point would there be a public hearing if it pertained to gross human rights abuses. The other just small correction, which is actually a very important point, you're absolutely right that the person who was applying for amnesty had to show that it was a political crime and they had to tell the full truth, but they were not required to show remorse or to apologize, which rankled some victims because people could tell the full truth with a sense of, well, I would do it again, and still walk away with amnesty if they met the other requirements.
Was that a change then within the commission's original intent? Because my understanding was that a contrition was part of the
process. No, it was a difficult issue that had to be worked out and was discussed at some length at the beginning, but there was never a requirement that they had to apologize, because there's a sense that if that was required, then one could never trust an apology when it came. And of course, if it was required, everyone would say it and some would not mean it. So it was left out. The connection between truth and justice also that you raise is a very important one. As you say, commissions do not have the power to prosecute, to put somebody in jail, even when they know perfectly well who was responsible for specific crimes and can show that. But you can use information from a commission, turn it over to the courts or to the prosecutorial authorities, and use that information for trials in the future. There shouldn't be a sense, which I think some people initially have misperceived, that somehow truth commissions are a way around having real justice in the courts, which I know is a real fear of people, and we should work in the future to only strengthen commissions so that they're more likely to play a positive role in prosecutions when prosecutions are possible at a later point.
I'd like to bring into the conversation Paul Van Sale, who is on a phone line from New York. Paul Van Zyl is the former executive secretary of the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission. But looking ahead to the future, Priscilla, he's recently been in Belgrade, I think, to consult with President Kostunica on the newly formed Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Yugoslavia. Paul Van Zyl, hello.
Hello.
So what do you think is going to happen then in Yugoslavia? There's a society that I know, and there's plenty of not looking at the truth in that society.
Well, let me start by saying that I think one of the reasons why Priscilla's book is so important and so timely is because it allows leaders throughout the world, precisely like those in Belgrade, to be able to draw on a range of comparative experience of Truth Commission type initiatives, which Priscilla so ably covers in her book. And in fact, in our recent trip there, we handed over copies of her book to the leadership in Belgrade to get them to be able to read and reflect on the different experiences throughout the world. I think President Kostunica is establishing a truth commission because he is painfully aware that the problem in the Balkans and the problem in the former Yugoslavia is not going to be addressed solely by punishment and prosecution. I think that's a vitally important part of the process of dealing with the past, but because of institutional constraints, because of resource constraints, because the criminal justice process is slow and difficult, it's only ever going to touch a relatively small number of cases and a relatively small number of perpetrators. And I think if you want to encapsulate what he wants to do with that commission in one sentence, I think in his words, he wants to hold up a mirror to the Serbian people to show to them what was done in their name. And I think that if he succeeds in doing that, it will be a vitally important first step in terms of morally reconstructing that country.
Well, when you say hold a mirror up to the Serbian people, does that mean that he sees the remit of this, of his commission or of Yugoslavia's commission, taking testimony from people representing the former parts of Yugoslavia, the nations that were the victims of the wars in the last decade? Bosnians, Kosovars, Croatians, whatever.
I think that he sees it its mandate in a regional context. I think you would be telling an artificial and partial truth by just focusing on one of the constituent parts of the former Yugoslavia. And so obviously you have to tell the story of Vukovar, you have to tell the story of Srebrenica, you have to tell the stories of the many thousands of violations, the vast majority of which occurred outside of Serbia, and the vast majority of whom were not Serbians in terms of the victims. But I think that he also has a sense, rightly or wrongly, that Serbs have been vilified, that they've been stigmatized, that they are, in the eyes of the Western world, always the bad guys. And I think that he also wants to use the commission to illustrate that at some points in history, Serbs were victims as well. And I'm not talking about World War II. I'm talking about the recent conflict. So I think he's committed to a relatively even-handed accounting. And if you look at the commission, it's an interesting mix of some fairly strong nationalists, but also some people with long and impeccable human rights track records. And I don't think that this is going to be a commission which is going to paint a partial or skewed view of the history of the conflict.
Let me just quickly ask you, Paul, is there a concern voiced by Kostunica and his advisors that they might come under immediate pressure, because so much of what they're going to be discussing, if this truth commission gets underway, is precisely the kind of information that so many Serbs are actually wanted for in The Hague for crimes against humanity? How are they going to work that one out?
Well, I think that the interrelationship between the truth commission and the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia is going to be crucial to get right right from the outset. If the Truth Commission exists in opposition to the tribunal as a substitute for real justice, as the soft option, then I think that it's going to fail, and I think it should rightly be condemned.
What's your reading, though, based on your recent trip about their intentions?
Well, I don't think... one of the things that I've learned from Truth Commissions is that if they set up with the right sort of people in them, they assume a life of their own, and the intentions of their founders don't necessarily translate into the operation of the institutions themselves. And looking at the I think there is a sufficient preponderance of human rights people on the commission for that commission not to be used as an initiative which will subvert justice, which will try and stymie the work of the tribunal. I just think there are too many people on that commission who have been strong supporters of the tribunal and who want to see a measure of cooperation.
What Paul is saying is certainly borne out in other countries. What's perhaps most important about any commission's work is that it's not only backed officially by the government, but given full operational independence. And as Paul suggests, if the right people are appointed and it's given a sufficiently flexible but rightly framed mandate, it can go far. And in many countries, there were commissions set up with not necessarily the purest of political motives from the start, but by the time they finished their work, they came out with extremely strong and important reports.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Michael is calling from Iowa City.
Hi.
Hi.
I've been thinking for a while now that Nelson Mandela deserves to win another Nobel Peace Prize for the invention of kind of the national equivalent of psychotherapy. I think the commission process has an extraordinary potential not only to help individuals in the country recover from their emotional scars, but to protect the fledgling democracies from being replaced by, you know, one tyranny being replaced by another, because even the revolutionary parties do come up before these truth and reconciliation committees, and it's really just a wonderful way to purge the nation of a lot of corruption.
Thank you, Michael. Nelson Mandela has won Nobel Prize. I don't think they give one in psychotherapy yet. Paul, does Mandela get the credit for making the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission work? And we have to be brief because we are running out of time. In your view?
I think there's an enormous amount that Mandela should be credited for. The example that he said, the careful balance that he strikes between a need for a thoroughgoing accounting with the past as well as an important attempt to proactively promote reconciliation. I think without both Nelson Mandela and Archbishop Tutu, the South African Commission would have been greatly impoverished.
And Priscilla Hainer, one final thought about the future of this process.
It is absolutely remarkable how many countries today are looking at the notion of establishing a truth commission. There must be a dozen countries where it's either underway or being very seriously discussed. And I think what we see down the road in Sierra Leone and East Timor and Panama and Peru and other places are going to be very, very interesting processes, different from what we've seen in the past.
Priscilla Hainer, author of Unspeakable Truths, thank you very much. And thank you, Paul von Sail, who is a professor of law at Columbia and is advising President Kostunica of Yugoslavia. We spoke earlier with Yasmin Suka in South Africa. I'm Michael Goldfarb, and this is The Connection.